Hi, today I want to talk about working with abused persons, and I'm thinking here entirely about pastoral care context. Someone makes an appointment with you, comes in to see you as pastor, and it turns out the agenda is to talk about abuse of some kind. So I want us to, you know, zero in right there. The longer I thought about this, the more difficult the whole task seemed to cover in a short period of time. I'm going to give you a bunch of which are clearly generalizations. It turned out last night when I finished making this list of stuff I'm going to look at, I could think of exceptions to almost every bit of generalization. So a lot of the art of ministry is sort of having enough experience in doing this kind of stuff that you know when the exception proves the rule and stuff like that, which is all stuff that will come with time in ministry. I have no doubt about that. It certainly did for me the first time someone walked into my office and told me that the issue they wanted to talk about was a very painful history of abuse in their family. I was completely clueless. And I'm hoping that this class has already given you a much better foundation than I had for responding in times like that. But let's see if we can't talk specifically about some of the elements of an appropriate pastoral response at a time like that. It's easier to list the things not to do, and I'll be doing a lot of that as we go along. But I thought it might be useful to look at the book of Job briefly, just a few quotes from some of Job's friends, because here we have a book that, well, there's a lot going on in the book of Job. It is at least a sort of a catalog of how to be unhelpful as a friend. Job's friends don't look very good in light of the arc of the whole book. God does not pronounce a blessing on their efforts to be helpful to their friend Job. There's lots of reasons for that. And I'll just look here at four texts. The first I want to look at is Job 4:7. Think now, who that was innocent ever perished? So the suggestion here is, you know, you got to be guilty of something, or this would not have happened. Now, there's lots of ways to communicate that. It doesn't have to be communicated directly, but there's lots of subtle ways in conversations. Now, it's not that any of us are, of course, innocents. We are all broken, damaged, hurting, missing the mark kind of people, and there's always stuff that we've got that has contributed to whatever mess we're in. But if you're talking to someone who's in the midst of suffering, and your focus is if as part of you trying to be caring to this person involves explaining the suffering by saying you must be guilty of something, it's really an attempt, I think, here in this context to defend the justice of God. And I can't think of anything more inappropriate in a conversation with people who are struggling with abuse issues than to feel like your role is to defend God's justice. It's just not an appropriate focus. It's a distraction. It can easily contribute to someone who, in the victim role, feels like they deserve to be punished anyway. That's how they've been understanding why they are suffering the way they are. They deserve this. And you're just reaffirming what the abusive system is already telling them. You deserved this to happen. It just sustains the dynamics of the abusive system, doesn't provide people a way out. Second thing, Job 5:17, blessed is the man whom God corrects, so do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. And this is a suggestion of a frame within which to think about suffering, that it is, God is the agent who caused this suffering. And so it's got to be for your own good, and an appropriate response would be gratitude. I am sort of astonished and outraged, to be quite frank, how frequently I will hear from people who have experienced abuse and who have gone to seek pastoral counseling and have had things like this said to them, that, you know, this is God's correction. This is so don't despise the discipline. And, you know, in the ears of someone in an abusive system, don't despise the discipline is going to be heard like, don't despise it when, you know, you just get the living daylights beaten out of you. It's not going to be heard as, don't despise the nurture and care of God who causes our growth. It's going to be just a way of defending the behavior of abusive people in this abusive system. And it's going to implicate God as the primary abuser, really. It's a way of saying, don't pay attention to what other people have done. Really, this is God's doing. And why anybody would want to do that to someone in an abusive system, I think it's largely out of ignorance that people would say these kinds of things at a time like this. God is not the one who is keeping you trapped in this abusive system. God's the one who calls you out to freedom and respect and non-shaming relationships. Not the one who says you should be grateful for the miserable mess that you're now in. So in my view, just very bad theology. I think the book of Job suggests as much. Job 11:16-17, you will surely forget your trouble, recalling it only as waters gone by. Life will be brighter than noonday, and darkness will become like morning. Now this is attempt, probably, to be hopeful, to be optimistic. It's kind of an exercise in what I call drive-by optimism. You know, I'm going to not deeply engage with you in your suffering. I'm going to dump a bunch of optimism on your front porch and drive off. And it is profoundly disrespectful, this kind of attempt. I mean, and primarily what it is, I think, this kind of cheerfulness and Hallmark cardishness in times of suffering is a way of managing my own anxiety. That is, if I know that you're suffering and I don't have adequate resources for managing my own anxiety, I'm going to try to, you know, make the pain go away in the quickest way possible, and suggesting you just cheer up because things are going to be okay eventually might be an effective way to manage my own anxiety. Probably not really, because it's not dealing with anything. It's just ignoring the suffering that's right in front of you. But for the person who's suffering, who's, you know, has to defend themselves against your relentless optimism, the assault of optimism in which you are engaged, it can be very debilitating. I mean, their connection with the trouble that you're suggesting they forget is maybe the most hopeful thing here. It may be what motivates them to do something different, to get out of this abusive system. If you just suggest cheerfulness within the system, right? Then you're just helping to sustain the abusive system, not really giving them a pathway out. Fourthly, a sort of example of pastoral care gone very bad is Job 35:12-13. And this has to do with God again. God does not answer when men cry out because of the arrogance of the wicked. Indeed, God does not listen to their empty plea. The Almighty pays no attention to it. Now, there's a implied theodicy here, and I think a text like this, seminary students and pastor types who enjoy thinking about theodicy will go that way with this text, and I'm going to encourage you not to go that way with this text. This is not really about theodicy. This is a way of communicating that God is at a distance from people who are suffering. If you experience God being at a distance, God is at a distance. That's what this kind of communication communicates, is that when you cry out, and very commonly people who are recovering from abuse have this experience of the absence of God. Remember that saying no phase that we talked about in an earlier presentation, during which it feels like God is absence, and where the important thing is not to defend God by saying, no, he's not absent. The important thing is to affirm the courage and the wisdom of saying no, because that's the next step in the right direction. This also implies that God's blessing is connected with holiness, that if you're not holy enough, you can't expect things to work out in life. Bad things happen to bad people. In addition to being bad theology, because we all fit in that sort of generic category, bad people, it's profoundly unhelpful to people who are suffering in the way we're talking about today. Okay, it's possible to do a lot more beating up on Job's friends than this, but I wanted to suggest it's interesting, is it not, that it's pretty easy to pull out of a text like that a lot of examples of things that I can assure you get said to people who have been abused. This kind of stuff happens a lot. So there's nothing new about really inappropriate communications to people who are suffering because of abuse. All right, let me go through this brief catalog of general advice. I try to sort of put things in some general categories. The first has to do with the agenda. What you're having a meeting with someone who's been abused, what's the agenda for this meeting? The first, this strikes me as really critical, is to let the abused person set the agenda. Again, there are some exceptions to that, but this is not a time for you to say, this is what I'd like to get done today. So that means that you don't lean into interrogating, investigating, digging, trying to get to stuff. Just let this person do the work they came to do today. And they will tell you what they want to get done. Or if they don't, it's perfectly fine to ask, how would you like me to try to be helpful for you today? Rather than, take charge, okay? Which might, again, a lot of things I'm going to suggest not doing today have to do with doing things that manage my anxiety rather than paying attention to this person. It might moderate my anxiety to, let's say someone comes into your office, they sit down, they divulge a little bit about abuse, and then they're quiet. And then they're just quiet. It might manage my anxiety, since silence tends to make us anxious. It might help me manage my anxiety by saying, well, I think this is the kind of thing we could work on today. But I think that's always counterproductive. If they came and, again, they have a need to be silent, honor that silence. It's a sacred silence. Respect it. Don't try to fix it. It's not a problem that needs to be solved. Let them lead. It's fine to ask them how you can be helpful. In fact, if that's a part of letting go of your to-do list and part of your commitment to working on whatever their to-do list is, that's a really helpful thing to say. How can I be helpful to you? It's really just foundationally important not to arrive at sessions like this with a list of action items or outcomes that you're hoping to get to. There's just all kinds of reasons not to do that, but it's particularly important not, for example, to think that forgiveness is going to be an outcome of today's meeting, so you're not going to think that forgiveness is this giant band-aid that you can put on every kind of suffering that this person's experienced. If that's confusing, go back and watch the presentation I did about forgiveness and repentance a couple of weeks ago. But sort of having your own agenda for forgiveness or reconciliation, or creating some kind of cathartic event that changes everything for this person, which might make me feel very competent because I got a lot done, is, again, responding to my needs rather than their needs. you know, some sort of big breakthrough because of our common conversation. Just kind of letting this be what it is, rather than having some sort of agenda for it, is a really important foundation for this conversation. The major exception to this agenda setting has to do with, I think I always come to meetings like this with the agenda, not necessarily very explicit, but I'm always evaluating the resources available to this person. I'll ask questions about that. Are you seeing a therapist? Have you seen a therapist in the past to talk about these issues? You know, have you ever participated in a support group around these issues? Things like that. And I will almost always talk about strategies for getting more resources, or at least at the very least the need for increasing one's resource base. Asking about available resource and doing a resource assessment is also, I suppose, and I'm going to talk more about specific advice for domestic violence situations a little bit later, but that's a case where there's a second kind of assessment, a risk assessment that's always going on. As, you know, what is this person at risk? Is it safe for this person to go home tonight? Is it safe for their kids to be in that house? That kind of assessment is part of the agenda that I bring to the table. It's okay to have agendas you bring to the table. It's just you can't let those agendas get in the way of the overall agenda setting for this meeting. Let the person tell you what this meeting is going to be like. Second, some thoughts about listening. Being quiet, I say, be quiet, listen, pay attention, and repeat. I just can't emphasize really enough how big a component this is in overall competency, both for pastoral care providers and for clinical professionals. Listening is foundational, and it's one of the ways in which you make space. This sort of making space for a conversation or a process to take place in is pretty complicated. It has to do not just with what you say, but body language and lots of other things go into that, making this a safe place or a relatively safe place to have a conversation about difficult material. Silence doesn't have to actually be completely silent. I have a story I love about this. I have a friend who graduated from Fuller School of Psychology with a doctorate in psychology, and been in private practice for maybe 15 years. When I asked him of all the things he learned in his years studying psychology at Fuller, what did he take away that was most helpful? And he said, I said, I didn't think it'd be that hard a question. What did you learn that was most helpful to you? And he said, And I really can't do his He has this astonishing His can communicate what it's okay to say what you just said. I'm still listening. We're not doing anything bad here. I'm really with you. It was this rich, layered, nuanced It's monosyllabic. It's has no overt content, but it is part of listening. And I have often thought that one of the keys to competency in either pastoral practice at a one-to-one level or in clinical practice is finding that really works for you. Now, it probably wouldn't be, he had a great, I don't have a great, I have kind of an average, you know, some people be, I don't know. It's so individual that it gets hard to suggest, but find some way to vocalize without speaking. Okay, so it sits in that territory between verbal communication and nonverbal communication. It's in that territory where if you want to think of it as verbal, it's okay. It's almost the same as eye contact or paying attention in nonverbal ways, but a really important part of creating a safe space. Juanita, in her talk on recovery from abuse, talked about observing with compassion, and I think that is a really good way to conceptualize what I would want to encourage you to do in situations like this. Remember, it was in counter-distinction to coming alongside person's judgmental self, for example. You come alongside their observing, compassionate self and try to support that, just as God has done for all of us, to observe compassionately at the beginning. And all that involves. Third thing I want to talk about here is we could talk about listening a lot. Okay, there's just a huge skill set there, and it's way beyond the scope of what I'm covering in this class. But making a commitment to learn how to listen is really key, and a lot of that again will be learning how to managing your anxiety when you're not speaking. People who are called into pastoral professions are often people who are strong speakers, and so we lean into our strengths when we're anxious, we lean into speech when we're anxious, and here's a context in which we need to lean into listening, which may make us anxious, may make us more anxious, rather than leaning into speech, which feels like something maybe we can control or using our strengths. We need to this involves increasing our tolerance for leaning into our weaknesses, and that's the deal. I think it's a pretty important part of the deal. Something about affect in situations like this, you need to make room for it, and let it be when it's there. If someone comes into your office and sits down, starts talking about abuse, and starts crying, what are you going to do? I mean, I wish in a face-to-face group we'd talk about this for 20 minutes. What's going to happen probably is for most of us, when we're in the presence of someone whose suffering is so acute and so present tense that they're weeping, is that we feel like we ought to do something rather than just observe compassionately. We should do something. And for pastors, not an atypical response would be to say, "Can I pray for you?" Okay, that gives me something to do that I'm reasonably competent at. And what will happen as soon as you make that offer is that the person will stop crying. Because here they are. They're in a very sacred moment, I would suggest, giving you access to some of the most painful parts of their life. And what they need is for that to be respected and honored, for you to give as much space as you can to it until your anxiety just overwhelms you. But my suspicion is that if someone comes and they're weeping, that that's what they came to do. That was the work they came to do today. And my job is not to fix that, to honor that. Now, you know, there's constraints if they're crying a half hour later. Then you're looking for ways to sort of honor that and thank them for the trust that represents. And suggest there might be some other pieces of the puzzle we should focus on today. I don't know. I'm not feeling like good things to say right then occur to me right now. But don't miss the sacredness of someone sharing with you the most painful thing in their life right now. Make space for that. Make room for it. If it makes you anxious, find additional resources for anxiety management for you. The issue there will be you, not this person. They're doing the work they came to do. You need to do the work you need to do, not in the context of that session, but you need to find yourself at a place in life where you get less anxious when people are suffering. And that's usually what's going on there, why our anxiety goes up, is that it's hooking stuff that we haven't worked on yet. Anxieties, our fears are connected to stuff we may have experienced in the past that we've not yet been able to fully process or acknowledge, and so on. So this, instead of letting our anxiety lead to truncating the process of this person who's come and trusted us so deeply, we need to pay attention to our anxiety and get some more help for ourselves. That would be a much more appropriate response to an increase in anxiety when someone is sharing in that way. Sort of avoiding extremes in our responses, I think, is pretty important here. This sort of panic, overreaction, catastrophizing, rage. There's in all of that a kind of over-identification, I think, with the person who's suffering. It's not just observing with compassion, it's getting sucked into the abusive system so that we're feeling the things people feel in that system, rather than sort of maintaining some solid ground, you know, close enough to communicate, but outside the system where there's a pathway out. Part of this is an attempt to compensate for either a flat affect or a flooded affect. Flat affect is when someone says, gives you a narrative that is just full of terror and shame and pain, but they do so with essentially no affect. This happened, then this happened, then this happened. And it's not an uncommon response or sort of way of narrating the abusive histories early on, because the affect is so painful that you have to shut that down. So you find enough courage to communicate the facts of what happened, and it will take some time before people have the capacity to tell that narrative with more appropriate affect. And it's really not possible for you to sort of add in the affect when they're not able to go there yet. So if it's a story with flat affect, you try to avoid compensating for that. It would be quite instinctual. And it may not be the thing to be working on right now, finding more appropriate affect. That's maybe not this first, second session conversation with the pastor. That feels like a really ambitious goal that you're bringing rather than what they're bringing. The other kind of sort of extreme that you'll notice is that people will not be without affect, but they'll be completely flooded affect. This is more like the person who came in and just started weeping and could not stop. The tendency for some people, I've certainly observed this a lot in pastors, is when there's this flooded affect, they're just sort of drowning in affect, is to back away just a little bit. I feel like I'm going to get hurt if I'm that close to this. And a flooding affect may trigger different things in us. If you have a history of someone who did a lot of flooding of affect, it's going to be very reminiscent of that and feel dangerous, and you're going to be just backing up a little bit. And we need to pay attention to those kinds of responses so that we can still stay focused, attentive, listening, observing with compassion, even though the affect may not feel to us like it's regulated well. Either it's not there at all or it's overwhelming. That'll come eventually. And what's important probably to focus on is they got themselves here. And this is just the beginning of a long process. And so you support them where they are, provide more resources if you can, hints about the next step forward, but not trying to sort of fix big problems like that in this session. Give it some room. All right, the fourth thing I wanted to talk about is talking. And I think I've already implied that for religious professionals, there's some dangers here because In many ways, this is what religious professionals get paid to do, to do speech. You can always ask the pastor to pray. You don't ask him if he feels like praying first. You just ask the pastor to pray, and he feels obligated to pray. Some advice about speech. First thing is, keep it simple. I just can't emphasize this enough. This is not a time for complicated theology. This is not a time to unpack theodicy. This is not a time for, the meaning of Greek verbs, blah-de blah blah. It's all just going to be inaccessible, unhearable. The reason for keeping it simple is you want to say things that people have a capacity to hear when they're in the midst of suffering. So it needs to be right on the ground. That's another expression of Juanita. Sit on the ground when you talk. Don't talk from a height of any kind. And that is probably the central thing I'd want to communicate about any kind of speaking or talking in a pastoral care situation with someone who's been abused. Second thing is, say less than it comes to mind to say. And as you're in the conversation, this person is speaking, and your mind is going, right? You're thinking, and you're coming up with things that you could say. If you say everything you could say, you're saying way too much. So you need to develop this capacity of saying, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say that. Maybe every third or fourth thing it'd be appropriate to say. There's a wonderful tradition in Al-Anon that I think is relevant here. Al-Anon is a 12-step support group for spouses of alcoholics. And one of the slogans in Al-Anon is that for every year in Al-Anon, you get 1 second. So 5 years in Al-Anon gives you 5 seconds. And what they mean by that is that somebody says something to you. Before you started working on your stuff in Al-Anon, you just respond, you just reacted. A year later, you notice you have 1 second then, right then, in that moment, where someone does something, says something, and you're tempted to react, and there's one beat before you respond. A couple years later, it's 2 beats. 5 years, you got 5 seconds in there, and that changes everything, those 5 seconds. So don't say everything that comes to mind to say. If you do, you'll be saying far too much. This is a, and there's a lot of ways to frame what's happening internally in us when we learn to do that. I'm, again, inclined to think that reactive speech is about managing our own anxiety. I feel like I'm not going to be very competent in this situation, so I better say something brilliant. And so we'll say something that is completely inaccessible to someone who's suffering at the level this person is suffering, and we'll say it too soon, too quickly. And it will, the problem is, it will sort of respond to our anxiety. We'll feel okay. I said something. I feel better that I didn't have nothing to say. But it may not be helpful at all. So say only a relatively small percent of the things that come to mind to say, or make sure that when something comes to mind to say, you wait like 3-4 seconds before you say it. It's a good pacing, I think, and gives you time to have second thoughts about whether it's appropriate. And also, maybe this person has not finished speaking. And those 3 or 4 seconds give them time to fill in stuff that would probably reshape significantly what it is that would be appropriate to say. Third thing, don't answer answerless questions. Seems pretty obvious, but when I listen to people who have been to pastors to talk about abuse, often they will say that he or she kind of got distracted answering questions, and I didn't even really understand what the question was. When when someone in a pastoral care situation, whether it's an abuse or any other kind of trauma, says, why did this happen? You, who are not in trauma right now, may be tempted to think, this is a request for, this is an opportunity for me to be competent as someone who's thought through all the issues of theodicy and why bad things happen, and I can talk about free will and divine providence and whatever, all of which is very, very fine and completely inappropriate in this context. Because the question, why did this happen, is not a question about theodicy. It's not a question coming from this, to oversimplify, cognitive processing a bit, it's not a question coming from their frontal lobe that's requesting a frontal lobe response. This is an anguished question, a question full of pain. And what you do in response to anguished questions is very different than what you do if you're sitting in an academic setting and responding to the question, why did this happen? Where it's all, I've got nothing against the frontal lobe, I love my frontal lobe, I love those kind of conversations. The question is whether that stuff is appropriate in pastoral care settings. And almost always the answer is no. What they need to know is that you have a capacity for observing compassionately the anguish that that question represents. And, all that thoughtfulness, may be wonderful that you have that capacity to do that, and there may be a time and a place where it's appropriate to unpack it, but it's probably not going to be here where someone is asking an anguished question rather than just a thoughtful one. Okay, I could rant on and on about that. It's okay in talking to people to ask simple questions. Have you ever worked with a therapist on these issues? What sort of how have people responded to you so far when you've talked to them about this? Do you have anybody you can talk about this stuff with? That's again collecting information about resources. It's sort of a resource assessment phase. Is it safe to go home tonight? It's another kind of assessment. It's also okay to not know what to say. I think that happens. It certainly happens for me a lot in conversations like this, where you feel a bit adrift. It all seems complicated, and none of the things. Once you develop a capacity to wait a few beats before speech, you find you have time to think a little more clearly about what to say, and sometimes you don't know what to say. And it's really okay to say that. It's okay to say, I don't know what to say about this. It just seems so painful and overwhelming. I wish I knew what to say, but I'm feeling kind of stumped right now. I don't know. Maybe there's nothing to say right now about this. I'm sure the time will come when there'll be things that need to be said, but right now, it feels like a time to be quiet. It's okay to say that. a prayer is a kind of speech. You need to think of it as gives a kind of speech. It gives a kind of communication. There are all kinds of dangers to pray. Praying can be a way. Prayer can be a shame delivery device. You've all experienced that. I'm going to be praying for you. Right? You've probably experienced or know someone who's experienced, I'll be praying for you, as really a way of saying, every time I pray for you, I'm going to be thinking of your shame for being bad, or something like that. So prayer can be a vehicle for shame. Prayer can be a vehicle for saying stuff you don't have the courage to just say to the person, look the person in the eyes and say. It can become speechifying, it's critical in these kind of settings to pray with utter simplicity in ways that simply remind God about the stuff we've just paid attention to and ask God to pay attention as well. Keeping it simple here is really important. Fancy prayers, You know, prayers that sound well-crafted, none of that kind of stuff matters here. Keep it simple. But do pray. Do pray with permission. You don't know, you probably don't know yet how many, what the spiritual abuse are issues that are part of this package that's sitting in your office. So don't make assumptions about prayer. Would it be okay if I prayed? Would it be difficult for you if I prayed? Those are fair questions to ask. I tend to advise people about the risks of post-conversation reactivity. This is obviously something that happens at the end of the conversation. So, you know, it's been my experience that sometimes when people talk about this, come into my office and talk to me about this, on their way home or later that day or the next day, they have second thoughts, they feel awful, they don't know what to do with those awful feelings. I just want to warn you about that. Sometimes that happens, that you wind up feeling like you did something bad or wrong, and I just want you to know, I think you did the right thing in coming to talk to me about this. It's okay to do what you did. I think it was a very courageous thing for you to do, and I'm hopeful that leads you to some helpful resources. There's something that you can always do, always affirm people for telling the truth. After all, this may be the first time they've told anybody about this. So they've been not telling people for what? I don't know, 20 years? Maybe. If it's incest or something like that. And now they're sitting in your office trusting you with something they have never trusted anybody with. Notice that. Thank them for that. Thank them personally for their trust, for their courage in finding a voice. Yeah, I just think that's always appropriate to do. I always, in terms of stuff that you communicate, I'm really inclined to say that it's always appropriate to communicate hope. Now, hope is also something that can get really screwed up. We talked about that drive-by optimism earlier, which is just really counterproductive. But there is a way to communicate hope and realism at the same time. And it typically needs to be baby steps in the direction of hope, leaning in the direction of hope. If it goes over to that sort of relentless optimism that is very much a part of the American character in many ways, I think it becomes counterproductive and people wind up going away feeling like they ought to feel better than they actually do feel because, you said it was hopeful. So, I mean, you can say, this would be so different in so many different situations, but let me just see if I can't think of what this might sound like. It might sound like I'm finding myself experiencing a little bit of hope today. I am not in despair about your situation. I don't think it's obviously very difficult, and there's a lot of hard work ahead of you, but I am not feeling that it's an impossible journey, and that feels good to me. I know you may not share that optimism right now, but I have seen people start where you are right now and get to a much healthier place in life. And I want you to know that. I want you to know that it is possible to get from here, which is very dark and discouraging, through a process arrive at a healthier place in life that's a more livable life, a more sustainable life, a more graceful life. And my prayers for you are going to be that you lean in that direction in the coming weeks. I don't know. That's just sort of one. This is not something I've written down. It's not a speech that I've memorized. Something like that can be crafted that's appropriate to each particular situation, and I think it might be helpful. Okay, finally, some comments about pastoral identity. We can spend a whole time on this, but the advice that I have, assuming that most of you are pastors in training rather than therapists in training, which is a different issue entirely, a different kind of identity, that if you're a pastor, be a pastor. And don't be all the other things that you might be invited to be. You're not an historian. There's a point in the recovery from incest, for example, where people feel a lot of desperation about getting confirmation about what happened. And that's a task that an historian might be able to do something about. But it's not a task that a pastor can do anything about. You're never going to know more about what happened than this person knows about what happened. So, you know, this means refusing to participate in that sort of historical enterprise, because it's not part of your calling. You have no expertise there. You can say it's certainly a plausible story. I can't think of any reason not to take what you say at face value, but there's no way I have of confirming for you what happened. I wasn't there. I'll never know as much as you know already about this. Similarly, playing roles of lawyer, therapist, juror, hero, private investigator, all these things are distraction. This person came to see you because, in part at least, of your pastoral role, your pastoral office. And, you know, there's a huge range of instincts in the Christian tradition about what that means. But it's not important what that means. It's important what this person experiences that as meaning. Why is it that they came to see you? And my suspicion is that it has, in most cases, to do with an awareness, sometimes just a beginning awareness, that what happened had spiritual significance. And any hope for fixing this will require spiritual resources. And that's to me a very hopeful starting point, because I believe that to be true, that the sorts of transformations that lead to healing will have to take place down at the heart of things, where all our spiritual commitments and engagements are entangled with everything else. Find some way to be a pastor. I realize that your sense of pastoral identity is probably just in the early stages of developing, and this will change over time. Don't see any mileage encouraging you to beat yourself up for not having a mature pastoral identity. Yes, yet you're probably just in the process of getting there. Let that take as long as it takes. It is a very complicated process where you come to terms with what that means. And it's actually a pretty wonderful journey, at least that's been my experience, to sort of honor the strengths and limitations of pastoral roles and let that be part of our calling. Secondly, a point that I've already made more than once is that you need to anticipate and you need to reject invitations to join the abusive system. It will be the default invitation, I think. It will come in a variety of ways. It may appear in very seductive ways, like, boy, that sounds good to be the hero. But sort of the pastoral identity, it will be completely lost if you get sucked into the abusive system. You have to stay outside enough to offer a prophetic pastoral voice that can say that it doesn't have to be like it is in there. There is a pathway out. Finally, there's lots of issues related to appropriate boundaries. Two, appropriate boundaries around time. Sometimes in sessions like this, it feels like there's no end point. And it's really important to develop a capacity, a skill set, for saying, this is all the time I have today. It's okay to say stuff like that. That's just sort of, in fact, most people will experience that as being very respectful, because you're not promising things that you can't give. And they may have experienced lots of people who promise things they couldn't deliver. Really important for you not to promise things you can't actually deliver on. And a simple reflection of that is, we're reaching the end of the time I have available. I have some other things I have to work on this morning. I've really appreciated the trust you've showed me today. I'm thinking that it might make sense for us to meet again, or whatever it is that you're going to end with. That sort of Boundary setting is a very practical but really important piece of the puzzle. People understand that your time is limited. Now, there's other boundaries that are part of that sort of getting sucked into the abusive system, having boundaries with respect to that sort of dynamic. There's also, as in any kind of pastoral counseling, the need to have sort of personal, physical and sexual boundaries that are appropriate to this relationship. If you have issues around sexuality that you have not dealt with, you might find yourself in a position where someone comes into your office and shares with you intimately the details, including perhaps intimate details about their sexual life experience. And it feels tender and they're sort of inviting you in to be part of that. Just saying that much, I think, might suggest to you that there's dangers here. Now, if just that sort of brief narrative of what might happen makes you really anxious, that's something you need to work on. There's lots of good resources about that kind of stuff. And it's the kind of thing that in the midst of doing this kind of work, when something like that comes to the surface, the very first thing you do when that session is over is you pick up the phone and you ask for help. Now, if you have nobody that you can call to ask for help, no one to supervise you around these issues, no therapeutic relationship to rely on, then the best thing you can do to increase your ability to function pastorally with people who've been abused is to get some more help for yourself. Nobody goes through a career in pastoral ministry without finding things like this that sort of blindside us, that where we find ourselves thinking stuff, imagining things that are really inappropriate for the context. And the sooner you can take ownership of that problem and do something about it, the better off you'll be. There's something there that needs to be worked on. It will stay there and just fester away until it gets some attention. Having been there and done that, I can assure you that it's possible to make progress on those kinds of issues. It is not a hopeless kind of "you're bad, pastor, shame on you" kind of thing. It is kind of normal, even for perfectly competent and experienced pastors to find themselves in pastoral care settings where they're blindsided by stuff. And the important thing there is not whether or not you should or should not get blindsided. The issue is, what do you do when you get blindsided by stuff and you find yourself just in disarray and disorganized and not knowing what to do or say, those kind of things. All right, I'm going to talk next time about self-care, and I'm going to make that point again, is that it's not possible to do pastoral care without having a lot of care yourself. Identify with people's sufferings, but don't make it about you. Even if you have personally experienced the same kind of abuse that this person has experienced, don't assume that they're experiencing the same things that you experienced. Because the same factual narrative is experienced by people in many different ways. So while it might be appropriate to say, "I just want you to know that I have also experienced this kind of abuse, and I think it'll be helpful for you to know that about me, but it also might mean that I have some things that have blindsided me here, and I just need to be honest about that." And both of us can be watching for ways in which that's helpful and not helpful. It's really okay for you to tell me if you experience something that I say is unhelpful. I really want you to be, because I've got some history here, I need you to be attentive to that. I think that would be experienced as very respectful. It's not it's not a failure to take responsibility for your own issues. It's sort of modeling, I think, an appropriate way to be responsible with your own issues. Finally, again, something I'll come back to next time about vicarious trauma. Just listening to trauma is traumatic. There's a tremendous amount of evidence to suggest that this is true now. To be engaged, in addition to just listening, to be engaged in all the ways helping professionals are involved, creates a trauma of its own and an increased need to take care of yourself. Just know that. There's no escaping that. It is part of competency in pastoral practice to sort of anticipate that trauma, that listening to trauma will be traumatic, and to have some sort of strategy or plan to respond to the way that impacts us. Okay, I promised I want to very briefly talk about a few ways in which this all feels differently in the context of domestic violence. You tend to have, I think, when you're working in situations of domestic violence, a little more room to set the agenda yourself, because you're working with someone who is in many ways cognitively impaired and can't ask the kind of questions or may want to work on stuff that's not relevant. And so you want to encourage them for sure to engage in a conversation about safety planning. How are you going to be safe for the next 24 hours? How are your kids going to be safe? And that is not an agenda they may have brought to the table, but it's a really important one for you to have if you have reason to believe that, that physical violence is part of this problem. You need to respect the person's choices that they make about safety plan. They may say, no, I don't need that yet. And then you sort of, your backup strategy is, if the time comes when you do need that, I want you to know that I'd be willing to help you with that. There are resources out there. I encourage you to have a plan well in advance. Well, in advance of actually needing a plan. There's a higher need in domestic violence situations, to emphasize your commitment to confidentiality about this. You're not going to call this woman's husband to ask him for his perspective about things. He probably doesn't know she came to see you. So you're going to do whatever you can to protect the confidentiality of this person. I think it's really important not to suggest for people in domestically violent relationships to go to marriage enrichment seminars, all those different kinds of strategies that are really about making good marriages better, I'd say. Even marital therapy, I think, is not an appropriate response to families where there's violence. People need to get individual help first, and do a lot of work before marital therapy has, I think, any chance of being successful. I think there's pretty good research to support that conclusion. Most organizations of therapists have adopted policies about that, that if there's domestic violence in place, marital therapy is just another opportunity for the abuser to dominate things, and that's all that you will see. It's important not to minimize the danger. It is something that often comes instinctively to us. If someone's feeling a lot of threat and danger, we might feel like, maybe they're exaggerating. That sort of sense of threat is really important motivator for them to do what needs to be done. So you don't want to undercut that. It's not your job to heighten it. Probably not, unless they're really minimizing the danger, and you have good reasons to believe that, and that's the case. But even then, I'd be cautious about that. But there's no advantage in minimizing the danger. Helping them see it with clarity, helping them make plans for what to do in light of the danger, that's all goal appropriate. But suggesting, I can't imagine that he would do that, for example. It could be completely inappropriate in this context. Even if the guy is the chairman of your deacon board and this is the first you've heard about it, okay, don't minimize the threat that this person is talking about. I think that's all I'm going to say. I have this very I have this sense of how inadequate a one-hour introduction to doing this is, but my suspicion is that you will have noticed a couple things through here that just sit with you as things you need to think about. I encourage you to do that. If you feel comfortable sharing that in the forum, that'd be really great. I'm probably going to post a couple of case studies in the forum this week for us to chew on. That gives us an opportunity to talk about some of these issues, and I look forward to our interactions there. Thanks for watching. Bye.